Hey there, it's Gary Parrish. It's Wednesday, November 13th, 2019. Welcome back to the CBS Sports Ion College Basketball Podcast, where we sometimes discuss camel fighting, and Leaky Black Matt Norlander is here with me. And the big news since we last recorded, it came Tuesday night. It was a monumental upset inside Rupp Arena. Final score, Evansville 67, number one Kentucky 64. The Aces, coached by former UK star Walter McCarty, closed as 25-point underdogs and won the game. It's the third largest betting upset in the past 15 seasons in a game between two Division I teams. Evansville closed as a 40-1 underdog on the money line. Buster Douglas was famously 42-1 against Mike Tyson. So this was basically the college basketball equivalent of Buster Douglas over Mike Tyson. Norlander, I know you did all the homework last night, so please expand on this for the loyal listeners. Among them, James Thomas, the homie JT, in detail just how crazy Evansville over Kentucky was on Tuesday night.
The further we got away from it, Parrish, the crazier I thought it was. I mean, when this was happening in real time, I thought, well, damn, this is the first truly big-time upset of the season in college basketball, and good on Evansville. But Evansville was picked 8th in the Missouri Valley. It's been a Division I program consistently since 1977. It's never made an AP Top 25 poll. It's obviously never defeated a number one team. It's never defeated a top five team, period, until what it was able to do at Rupp Arena on Tuesday night. I think it was just an incredibly sweet subplot that Walter McCarty, one of the more beloved Wildcats ever, was able to pull this off in his second season as coach of Evansville. Although, Parrish, I got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Which of these is most likely to happen next? John Calipari schedules Evansville, John Calipari schedules Indiana, or John Calipari retires?
It schedules Evansville. I mean, I think just because this happened doesn't mean you just have to stay away from it forever, right? I mean, it's just, even John last night after the game was like, hey, I've been doing this for a long time. These kinds of things happen. It is true. These kinds of things do happen. Not often.
Yeah.
Arguably never before in Rupp Arena, but things like this do happen. I don't know that John has any real reason going forward to be worried about non-league home games against Evansville, but who knows?
Hey,
who knows?
Dodging that Evansville. Right now, Evansville as a program is undefeated in its history against Kentucky. Tuesday night was the first matchup between the two, which I found relatively surprising given they are, you know, geographically, they're not that far apart. I figured maybe that would have happened before, but it did not. Here's a list of, and credit to our CBS Sports researchers who tossed me this as I was running, or I was preparing and doing a bunch of stuff on HQ for this on Tuesday night. Schools to win against number one ranked teams that came from outside the traditional power conference structure. Evansville, prior to that, you probably remember this, Parrish. It was just 4 years ago. I definitely remember it. Remember when Northern Iowa was able to beat Carolina? And that was in Northern Iowa. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do remember that.
Yep, that was the most recent one. Prior to that, though, it was Butler, and that was over Indiana. That was, you know, when Butler was a member of the Atlantic 10. That was the 1 year, by the way. Stevens was still the coach there. That was the one season Butler had the transition from the Valley to the A-10 before going to the Big East. UNLV beat Carolina in Vegas in 2011. Yeah, and prior to that, how about Mark Gottfried's number one ranked Alabama team in 2002 losing at Rick Majerus in Utah? I mean, a lot of these instances were legitimately really good teams. They were just from outside the power structure. So the last time this really happened, because right out, you had Temple over Cincinnati, Xavier twice over Cincinnati in the 90s, UMass beating Kentucky and Arkansas when Cal was at UMass. Both those times, UMass was in the A-10, obviously, and beat number one ranked Kentucky, number one ranked Arkansas, and, by the way, also beat a number one ranked Carolina team. I mean, Cal really just had it rolling. That's awesome. But so the last time we had something similar to this, a true mid-major winning on the road against a number one ranked team in the regular season was actually Seth Greenberg's 49ers of Long Beach State in 1993 when it defeated Roy Williams' Kansas Jayhawks. I mean, it's wild. And prior to that, you got New Mexico beating Arizona in 88. So it does happen, but this kind of thing specifically, I mean, it's rare. A Truman Major winning in a road environment against a top team, and to do it against Kentucky. I know they got some young pups, but this isn't as young of a Kentucky team this season as it was last season. A sizable upset. There's no doubt about it. And Parrish, I gotta say it. I mean, this could be worth a seed line bump come March. Eh? I mean, you know it.
I love your seed line bump tweets, or like it's just a random sentence in a column, like on Selection Sunday, this is going to be worth a seed bump. Nobody loves to discuss seed bumps after November wins or losses more than Matt Norland.
That's correct, and that's because November outcomes can have implications.
What I hope is the chair of the NCAA selection come up. My dream is to sit down on Selection Sunday with the chair, because I'm usually in New York, and they are usually there in studio with us, and we get them on camera somehow, whatever. Yeah. We talk to them, and I want somebody to say, you know, Kentucky was on track to be a one seed, but if you go back to November 12th, they took a loss at home to Evansville, and that was a seed line bump in the wrong direction. You're the only one who uses that term, I think.
I will trademark it gladly. How about this, though? Okay. Are we going to do a Wofford thing all over again here? I'll tell you this. I would think that you would actually agree with this. If Kentucky is in the discussion for a number one seed, losing, and Evansville winds up not being a 24-win team, let's say even Evansville's even, you know, third in the Valley, losing at home to Evansville will be such, you know, a noticeable wart that this could cost Kentucky a one seed if it otherwise goes about its season the way that we expect it to when it's fighting with other ones. You know, barring four or five other teams near the top of the seed line, then yeah, obviously, like this can be a loss of serious consequence. Now, if Kentucky gets right, if this is an aberration, I mean, I did say Kentucky would only have one loss until it faced Texas Tech in the middle of January. That can still technically be true, so I'm going to cling to that. But if it's able to otherwise, you know, get back on track, you know, finish atop the SEC, then it should be able to overcome this. But this is one of those where you take another one that maybe you shouldn't. I think it just can be exacerbated. That's all. Because, listen, the historical meaningfulness of this kind of win. I mean, biggest win in Evansville program history, and Kentucky, which loses as the number one team as much as almost anyone else, which is a testament to the program's strength. But still, this is definitely a biggie. There's no doubt about it. I don't think that we can, you know, overstate how big it is for Evansville, and, you know, how damaging it can be eventually to the resume of Kentucky. That's all.
There's no question. I mean, this is not like we talked on the previous podcast about Florida losing at home to unranked Florida State by double digits. And that's not a good loss. But that's still like Florida State. It's still Leonard Hamilton. He's got real ACC players. It's a different deal. At tip-off, Kentucky was ranked number one in the AP poll. Evansville was 169th at KenPom. And though John Calipari did say again last night that these things do happen in the sport, like I mentioned earlier, they are very, very uncommon. For instance, Kentucky last night becomes the first number one team in the AP poll to lose to a team that had 11 or fewer wins in the previous season. Because, again, Evansville was 11-21 last night. Kentucky becomes the first number one team in the AP poll to lose to a team that had 11 or fewer wins in the previous season since Stanford did it in the 2003-2004 season. So this is really, really uncommon. I thought it was interesting. Walter McCarty was asked last night, where does this rank in terms of things you've been attached to inside Rupp Arena? Because obviously he was on a national championship team at Kentucky that played a lot of games inside Rupp Arena, and he said this is at the top. Coaching Evansville to a upset of Kentucky, his alma mater, is more meaningful to him than anything he did while a player at Kentucky. I don't know how that'll go over in Lexington, but certainly understandable. You saw him last night celebrating with the team. It was awesome. He was a member, again, of that 1996 team, averaged 11.3 points and 5.7 rebounds, was the third leading scorer on that team that won the championship with nine future NBA players, finished 34-2. Trivia time.
Okay.
Who did that Kentucky team lose to that year?
It had two losses.
They lost twice.
I love this trivia time. That is my favorite college team of all time. I was a bona fide this was that team, like, solidified my love. Like, I was a huge Bulls and Jordan fan, Parrish. And then Jordan retires. Kentucky's getting awesome. I was into college basketball before this, but the 95-96 Kentucky team was the team that made me for life choose college hoops over the NBA. And Tony Delk is my dude. I mean, that team was loaded. Delk, McCarty, Ron Mercer, Antoine Walker, Derek Anderson was on that team. Anthony Epps was on that team. Just, I firmly believe that you place those dudes in 2019-20 college basketball, and they're still wrecking shop on almost anyone. The losses that year, I got to think that all right, I'll say Arkansas, but I feel like they might have slipped a little bit there.
Did not lose to Arkansas that season.
So they had two losses. I'm pretty sure, because I did something a few years back researching this, I am pretty sure that they lost early to Cal's UMass team. It was either that team or it was the year before that. I know Kentucky lost to Cal when he was at UMass. I know that happened.
That's it. That was the first loss. Second game of the season.
Okay.
Neutral site showdown between UMass and Kentucky. John Calipari coaching UMass. Rick Pitino coaching Kentucky. It was at the Palace in Auburn Hills, and UMass did beat Kentucky. That was the first loss. And then they didn't lose again until the title game of the SEC tournament against who?
96. Is it gettable? So it's SEC. So it's in the SEC.
You will remember it as soon as I tell you.
Jeez, why don't I remember it now, though? Not Arkansas. Who was good in the SEC that year? Oh.
You mean you want a hint?
No. Tell me it wasn't Mississippi State.
It was Mississippi State in the SEC. The title game.
Yes.
Dante Jones, the pride of Northeast Mississippi Community College, who went on to become a Bulldog after getting like 48 credit hours in one summer semester at a Mississippi junior college.
Stop.
I don't remember the details, but you can look this up. They, like, I believe, literally changed the rules because Dante Jones graduated from junior college in like 2 weeks.
That's
so he could get eligible at Mississippi State. And he was the SEC tournament MVP. And then here's the thing. I was about to say that some people don't remember. Perhaps everybody remembers it. So they finish that Kentucky team with just two losses, 34-2. The two losses are to UMass and Mississippi State. UMass went on to the Final Four, and Mississippi State went on to the Final Four.
That's right.
So the only two losses came to fellow Final Four teams. And then, final part of trivia time, who did Kentucky beat in the national championship game in
1996? 96 is Q's. I'm almost
positive. There you go.
Q's. Hold on. I think I can guess the score. 76-67, right? Is that it?
What? I can't guess scores. Are you out of your mind?
Is 76-67 the score?
I don't know. How would I know?
Can you? Well, are you not looking at like a... Hold on.
No, I mean, I looked all this stuff up last
night. I'm almost positive.
1996, Kentucky basketball schedule.
I had that game on VHS. I've watched that title game at least 7 or 8 times. I'm like at a 95% certainty that the final score was 76-67.
Feels like I'm suddenly doing a podcast with John Rothstein. you watched the 96 title game 8 times.
This is when I was 14, 15 years old, of course. Yeah.
76-67 was the final score.
Give it to me. There we go. I'll talk 96 Kentucky anytime you want. That is by far my favorite team of all time. So good stuff. And back to present day, just a quick note on Kentucky in general. I think this will be more of an aberration than not. Kentucky over the years under Cal has had some hiccups in November, but they never had a loss like this. And watching the game, second half in particular, I did not see the first half, but once you see it's tight at halftime, you tune in and see where it goes. The front court still needs a lot of fermentation. There's no doubt about it. And then the back court, Maxey, if he is not on Parrish, if he's not the guy that's going to give you shots, big shots, and you're not going to run the offense through him late, Kentucky is going to find itself with some issues because I don't know if you're going to have a situation where, you know, quickly my guy Nate Sestina, really anyone else is going to step into a role where they can be a 1B to Maxie's 1A in terms of, okay, we need a bucket and we know that we can rely and count on you. I still think Kentucky will be a top five level defense by the time we get to early March. But offensively, with what I saw last night, maybe they figured some stuff out, but I don't think that we're going to look up 22 games into the season and suddenly discover that Kentucky has three surefire go-to guys that can give you a bucket from 18 feet if you need it. So that is the one thing that I have more concerns about now for sure than when we did the pod after MSG.
John Calipari afterward questioned the toughness of the team, and you know that is I'll trust him if that's one issue. Another one is they're just not shooting the ball well. They were 4-17 from three last night. They're now shooting 24.5% from three on the season. That ranks 289th in the country. Ashton Hagans was one of eight from the field. And so, you know, I know after the game, I think it was Seth Greenberg, Dan Dockett were in studio, or perhaps they were in studio at halftime of Memphis, Oregon, and they were talking about Kentucky, Evansville. Maybe that was it. Either way, I saw them talking, and they said, listen, they got to figure out who is going to be the guy who can go get you a bucket when you need a bucket. And I honestly thought that like that was already figured out. I mean, I know it's early, but it's got to be Tyrese Maxey. He's got to be that guy, and he just wasn't that guy in this one.
He was not that guy in this one, and we'll see if that becomes a thing. I still like Maxey to be that guy in plenty of instances, and I think that he can show – and prove to be a top 15 level player in America. But credit to Evansville, they never let Kentucky even get three consecutive possessions where it looked like they were going to turn it. And that almost always happens, not just in a situation with the number one team playing a mid-major, but like Kentucky at Rupp, like usually the breaks go their way. It didn't. Credit to McCarty. It really is something, man, that that one of the more beloved players on the greatest team in program history was able to, and yeah, that is the greatest team. And I don't want to hear anyone talk about 2012 or 2015. 95-96 Kentucky is the best UK team ever. He's able to do that and get just a huge win. And credit to ESPN Stats and Info on this. I guess in the past 20 years, the Valley, shouts to the Valley, 4-3 as a conference against number one ranked teams. That's the best winning percentage by any league in America. Granted, it is a smaller sample size, but you get seven cracks at a number one team and you're above 500. That's good stuff there. Evansville's able to keep that up. And obviously the most recent instance of that was when Northern Iowa did it on its home floor, as we mentioned earlier, against Carolina. So we will wait and see. Evansville better not look overlook Indiana Kokomo because there's only a two-day turnaround. They're going to play Indiana Kokomo on Thursday. I think that was a Brian Wilson B-side as opposed to what the Beach Boys actually put out. And meanwhile, for Kentucky, it will have Utah Valley at home. I would suspect, I mean, don't want to get too far out of it ourselves, Parrish, but Kentucky doesn't have another notable game until maybe home against Georgia Tech, but really it might be CBS Sports Classic. Like, Kentucky should get on the right path here. Utah Valley, Mount St. Mary's, Lamar, UAB, Fairleigh Dickinson, Georgia Tech, all those are at home. That's their next month plus. Then they get Utah on a neutral out in Vegas as a kind of a warm-up before the CBS Sports Classic, where we'll be there against Ohio State on December 21st. So I would think Kentucky is going to roll here and be okay, but if we're talking about him again in any sort of game context, it's not going to be good news because otherwise we probably shouldn't have much reason to discuss him at all.
I wonder if there's ever been a bigger discrepancy in competition in a three-day span than going from Rupp Arena playing the number one team in the country to a home game with Indiana Kokomo.
I don't know, but Indiana Kokomo is an incredible – I mean, that's an album name. It really is. That is an album name. I don't know. In such a small period of time, you get up to go to Rupp Arena, number one team in the country, then you got to turn around and face Indiana Kokomo, whose jerseys were probably stitched together by like the assistant coach. So that is quite the whiplash there. And then Evansville will welcome in SMU into its building. Shouts to Evansville for getting a home game against SMU. That'll be next Monday.
Elsewhere in the sport on Tuesday, a couple of five-star prospects committed to Big 12 programs. We're going to get to that next, but first, check this out. Are you looking for a new basketball shoe? If so, this is Gary Parrish here to tell you that the New Balance 2-Way V4 features the groundbreaking use of fuel cell technology with fresh foam, creating the ultimate combination of rebound and cushioning. Every step feels explosive and dynamic, and the upper construction features a lightweight textile that's supportive and breathable. So whether you're hitting the clutch shot or locking down the opposition, the 2-Way V4 gives you the tools to play at a high level. Learn more and purchase the 2-Way at newbalance.com.
The all-new Hyundai 2024 Santa Fe is equipped with everything you need to break free from the dull work week and embark on an adventurous weekend with your family. The Hyundai Santa Fe's features like available H-Track all-wheel drive, standard third row seating, available dual wireless charging pads. You've got the H-Track all-wheel drive so you can take on those dirt trails and kick up some mud. Or the third row seating gets your whole family in to experience the thrill together. The dual wireless charging pads make sure that no one gets stuck in the great outdoors with a dead cell phone. Think about those adventurous activities you can do, like me taking a ski trip up with the family, maybe going on a camping expedition, anything and everything. Learn more about the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe at HyundaiUSA.com. Call 562-314-4603 for complete details.
So a couple of five-star prospects committed to Big 12 schools on Tuesday. Bryce Thompson picked Kansas, while Navarre Burnett picked Texas Tech. Norlander, what surprised you more? A five-star prospect picking a school possibly facing serious NCAA sanctions, or a five-star prospect picking Texas Tech, which obviously isn't common?
The Texas Tech one was, I'll say, by a hair, only because – now, I'm not stunned. Chris Beard's got this thing going. But even, like – a year ago, and the reason why this happens is you get, you know, Chris Beard not only gets Texas Tech to the title game of the sport and has completely changed the reputation of the program, but in back-to-back years, he's been able to, you know, between Zaire Smith as a freshman going to be, you know, top 15 level pick, and Jared Culver being a lottery pick the year after, he is proving to be a great coach who's able to take real athletic talent and develop it into NBA readiness with a quickness there. But a year ago, I still would have thought Texas Tech was not going to be capable of landing a top 20 kid. To me, that's just a little more surprising. With Bryce Thompson, over the past week, the buzz had increasingly become that Kansas was going to win out here over the likes of Oklahoma State and Oklahoma, which were recruiting him for much longer. Oklahoma State was actually the first one to really get in on Bryce Thompson. And listen, I think that Bryce Thompson can be an immediate impact player next season when he's a freshman. I think he's probably a two-year kind of guy, but a smart player, awesome kid. It is a little surprising that he picks Kansas because you and I have both said on this podcast, we believe that the Jayhawks are going to face a postseason ban next season. But credit to Thompson and his family, like, you know, they know what they want, and they have been assured to whatever level they need to be assured that their concerns can be alleviated to whatever level. I don't know. We'll wait and see. And maybe, you know, playing in the NCAA tournament winds up being a thing that Kansas does next season. Or maybe that's not the be-all, end-all for what Bryce Thompson wants to get out of his college experience and best getting to the NBA. So I actually give him credit for making this kind of choice because – as we've seen with other schools in the past, well, forever, but really specifically the past 5 to 7 years, Parrish, schools that have been under the microscope and are, you know, apparently awaiting punishment. North Carolina, which never got it, still lost on plenty of recruiting battles time after time after time. A lot of guys wouldn't have make that choice. Bryce Thompson does, and that is a significant get for Kansas's 2020 class. He's the first five-star in this class. Obviously, Kansas did not land a five-star in last year's class. So, yeah, this does still befuddle some people in the industry. There's no doubt about it. But if that's what he wants to do, more power to him. No flack from me on that, and I'm excited to see what he can be as a college player. I think he'll be very fun and potentially a top 50-level guy by the end of his freshman season.
Yeah, I think I'm with you mostly on this. He wanted to be at Kansas. His father played for Bill Self at Tulsa, so there's a long family connection there. And he's not going into this ignorant to the situation. He might be misguided, and not by anybody intentionally, just like sometimes people believe what they want to believe. Like, there's a whole bunch of Memphis fans right now who are just convinced they're going to be fine. And they might be, but I'm not convinced of that if they continue to be in defiance of the NCAA. So he could be, again, misguided, nobody's fault, about the realities of what Kansas is dealing with. But he's not ignorant to the situation. He addressed it even after his announcement and said that, you know, he's talked to the athletic director. He's talked to the coaching staff. He and his family are comfortable with going to Kansas under these circumstances. I will say, though, if I were his father, unless I was genuinely dead set on we're going to Kansas no matter what, and if it means we don't get to play in the NCAA tournament because of a postseason ban, that's fine. We'd still rather be at Kansas than anywhere else. Like, if that is their opinion, then that's fine with me. Who am I to sit here and tell people what they ought to do in terms of stuff like that? But if the opinion is we're going to Kansas because that's where we want to be, and we don't think we're going to be banned from the NCAA tournament, but if we were going to be banned from the NCAA tournament, we would probably look at other options, then my advice would be don't sign a letter of intent early. Or get some sort of agreement from Kansas in place that if this does go the wrong way, that you can respectfully and politely be released from your commitment and enroll somewhere where you might be able. Well, you'll have an actual chance to play in the NCAA tournament, because I don't know that Bryce Thompson's a for sure one and done guy. In fact, I know he's not a for sure one and done guy, but he's a possible one and done guy. And I just think it would be unfortunate if somebody who was always dreamt of playing in the NCAA tournament suddenly had that opportunity ripped away from them in what is maybe going to be their only year of college. And I don't just say this about Kansas. Like, honestly, and who knows what's going to happen in the situation between Memphis and the NCAA. Perhaps they can find a resolution that satisfies both sides, and this doesn't continue to be a defiant act by the University of Memphis that could lead to big problems. But let's pretend for a second that there is no resolution reached. James Wiseman continues to play under these circumstances, mm-hmm. and then leaves for the NBA, and then the NCAA eventually sends a notice of allegations to Memphis, accusing it of level one violations because it knowingly played an ineligible player. I would say the same thing about that. If I were a five-star prospect, if this thing doesn't get resolved formally between Memphis and the NCAA, if I were a five-star prospect, I would not commit to Memphis right now, because you don't know what you're walking into. So I don't say that about Kansas any differently than I would say it about literally any school under these circumstances. You've just got to be careful. And so we'll see. But again, it's a testament to that staff and the relationship they built with the family that they would be able to get this done under these circumstances, because I don't know that many staffs and many schools would be able to get this done under these circumstances. As for Texas Tech, this is the highest rated player to ever commit to that school in the sport of men's basketball. And before he did it, the highest player to ever commit to this school in the sport of men's basketball did it last year. Mm-hmm. So Chris Beard is recruiting at an incredibly unusual high level relative to the history of the program at which he works. For which he works. And I'll just say, like, when you were listing the guys in the country who can do more with less than maybe anybody, that you think, man, you just give them any roster and they'd be good, and you give them a good roster, they'll be great. I do think at this point, and maybe you could throw some other names in there. Rick Bird's retired, by the way, Norlanders. You can't use him anymore.
I know.
But Tony Bennett and Chris Beard? Probably are 1-2 on that list right now. And if you're now telling me Chris Beard's going to be consistently enrolling top 50 players, five-star prospects, then we know who is going to be Kansas's biggest consistent challenger going forward. It's going to be Chris Beard at Texas Tech unless he's Chris Beard somewhere else.
You are on the money. You make a lot of good points on both those situations with both those guys. I'll also note your point about not signing an LOI is a big one, because and I don't know how many listeners may or may not realize this, but the Big 12's transfer guidelines are really among the strictest and hardest to get around in the entire sport. It is almost unheard of for an in-league Big 12 to Big 12 transfer. You'll recall that Baker Mayfield was initially even ruled ineligible, and the only reason he got around that through the waiver process was because he was a walk-on and had to go through a fairly stringent process to even be able to play at Oklahoma. Had Baker Mayfield been a regular scholarship player going from Texas Tech to Oklahoma, he never plays for Lincoln Riley and probably never wins the Heisman Trophy and never gets drafted number one overall. So I only bring it up to say, if anything were to happen where Bryce Thompson decided I'm not going to go to Kansas and he signed a letter of intent, well, then I would think North Carolina has a clear edge, because get him deciding, you know what, I'd still like to stay close to home. I'd like to play for Oklahoma or Oklahoma State. Kansas isn't going to want to sign off on that. No shot, no way, no way in hell is that going to happen. So if I was his family, I would keep that in mind. And if you're pot committed, no matter what, you know, more power to you. But just for those, you know, who might be Sooners or Cowboys fans thinking like, well, maybe something happens, you know, by February, Kansas gets hit by the NCAA and we can maybe get back and Bryce Thompson will decommit. Because I know that is a hope among that fan base right now. Just know that if he signs an LOI, I won't say it definitely won't happen, but it is extremely unlikely. And then just one final thing on Beard. He is, you know, I think that he is just a tremendous fit there. Not by any means the same personality at all, but if you told me, like, Ed Orgeron, it seems now to be a lifer at LSU. He's just such a natural fit for that program. If you told me that Texas Tech is going to be 1 seed, 2 seed, 3 seed, 4 seed, you know, 85-90% of the time over the next 15 years, because Chris Beard stayed there and he bypassed job offers for more money at bigger places, it wouldn't totally stun me. I think that Chris Beard can win just about anywhere, but his specific fit at Texas Tech is a really awesome, it remains an awesome story in college basketball, and damn, wouldn't it be a cool thing if we just happen to be witness for the next decade to see in Texas Tech trade jabs on even footing with Kansas and basically turn into a top two, for sure, top three program within that league. Getting these kind of guys like Nirmari Burnett will ensure that happens. And heading into next season, yeah, the Red Raiders are shaping up for sure, it would seem, to be a preseason top two team in the league.
One last thing on the Bryce Thompson situation. You and I are on the same page with this. If he just is going to go to Kansas no matter what, postseason ban, no postseason ban, I'm going to Kansas, rock chalk. That's fine with me. And then there's nothing else to talk about. Just go to Kansas and be done with it. Mm-hmm. But short of that, if the reality is I'm going to Kansas because it's where I want to be, and also because I don't think they're going to deal with a postseason ban. But if they were going to deal with a postseason ban, then I would consider other options. Then that is when I would not sign the letter of intent. And also this, then the only way you get in trouble is college basketball players, the season doesn't start till November. They enroll in June, typically June. Mm-hmm. And what I think is an absolute worst case scenario under these circumstances, the hypothetical, and it's only a hypothetical, but the hypothetical that Bryce Thompson wants to go to Kansas, as long as it's not going to be a postseason ban, but if there were going to be a postseason ban, he would like to explore other options. Then the worst case scenario becomes everything's cool. No reason to really be worried. You believe everything's going to be fine. You enroll in June. You're a student at Kansas. And then in August, the punishment comes down, and it's a postseason ban 2021. And now you're trapped. You're at Kansas, and you enrolled before the punishment came, and then the punishment comes, and now here you are. It is why I genuinely believe, and I don't expect the NCAA to start operating this way, but I wish that the NCAA would make a rule on itself,
yeah,
where you cannot put a school on a postseason ban, mm-hmm, once the freshmen enroll at that school. You shouldn't be allowed to trap people. If you can get it done, announce the punishment before the freshmen enroll or the transfers enroll or whoever, that's fine. Then they know what they're walking into. But I hate the idea that you can enroll somewhere in June and with the school not facing a postseason ban, and then in August or September, October, they could hit you with a postseason ban and rip your possibilities away. Literally no fault of your own. It's why I don't have any problem with the NCAA putting a postseason ban on Georgia Tech. I do not think they should have been able to do it to Georgia Tech in the 2019-20 season after the student athletes had already enrolled for the 2019-20 season. So that's just something. That's a larger point I wanted to make about these situations in general.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. All right, let's spin it forward here, because we've got a big game Thursday night between Seton Hall, Michigan State. It's by far the biggest game left of the week, and no Miles Powell, as we discussed on the previous podcast. So that's to me, that's the big one on Thursday. Wednesday's got Purdue at Marquette. Nova, Ohio State's actually a pretty solid one. I'm curious to see what that one turns out to be. And Will Wade goes to VCU with his LSU Tigers to coach. I tell you what, VCU fans are not going to treat Will Wade well at all at that game. Actually, that might be my highest curiosity for Wednesday night in general. But MSU Seton Hall is the big boy game on Thursday. Cassius Winston expected to play as his family determines funeral arrangements. As of now, as of us recording this podcast, the plan is for Cassius Winston to play in that game. And if indeed he does, even though Michigan State will be on the road, it will have certainly an advantage in personnel. So I'm curious to see how Michigan State responds here. How Seton Hall looks without its best player. GP, what most intrigues you about this game overall?
Oh, well, first off, let's be honest. It's less intriguing than it otherwise would have been.
Yeah.
Because a preseason first-team All-American is not going to be available. They have not at Seton Hall put a timetable on Miles Powell's return, but they have acknowledged he is not going to play on Thursday. Still, and remember, this game's going to be played at the Prudential Center. Mm-hmm. And Adam Zagoria reported that they've already sold 14,000 season tickets, so it's going to be a great crowd. And they really haven't seen any change in ticket sales, according to an associate AD at Seton Hall, with the news about Miles Powell. So Seton Hall fans are still going to be there. It's still the preseason number one, coached by a Hall of Famer, playing you in a non-league showdown. But obviously, it would be a more interesting situation if Miles Powell were available. And I do think it probably puts more pressure, and there's pressure anyway, I guess, but more pressure on Michigan State to knock this out. If you're Seton Hall, you lost your best player, not just your best player, but one of the best players in the country, whatever. But at Michigan State now, the idea that you could go from preseason number one to 1-2 with a loss to a team that subsequently lost to Evansville at home, and a loss to a team that would be missing its best player, that is no way to start a season. I think there's real pressure on Tom Izzo's Spartans to go into Newark and get this done.
There is, because after this, there's a ton of pressure. I mean, getting a kind of win like this would be humongous. Michigan State's going to win its next home game against Charleston Southern, and then it will go to Maui. And here's you want to get a win like this, because then it's going to play a Virginia Tech team at Maui on that first Monday. Should win that, but Mike Young's doing a really good job right off the bat there with the Hokies. Then we get the winner of Georgia versus Dayton, and you'd either get a Georgia team. Anthony Edwards, we'll talk about him in games to come here, down in the podcast, but he's been awesome immediately. He's been a very good player right away. Might be the best freshman in this most recent recruiting class. Or they'd play Dayton, who is no joke either. So that's an intriguing second game, and then it could potentially have Kansas awaiting them. Would Michigan State in a title game type situation in Maui? So Michigan State will not be short or shy on big win opportunities. Neither will Seton Hall. I mean, Seton Hall has arguably more if the bracket breaks their way in the Bahamas for big game resume building opportunities than anyone. But yeah, this is one of the more critical non-conference games that we have here in terms of like a true road environment. I mean, this is a fantastic thing, a great deal. But I'll be interested to see how Cassius plays, if indeed he does play, and just that environment should be terrific overall. But yeah, that is by far, you build your Thursday, for the listeners who haven't peeked ahead at Thursday, I mean, you build your Thursday night around that. There's no other good game. There's nothing. The next best game is Penn State against Georgetown. I mean, that's a close second, but yeah, so that's the biggie as we head into the weekend there. I think Michigan State's going to win. I'm not going to log this for our. We'll save our picks for the record and our season long chase for just weekend stuff. But I do think that I'll take Michigan State to win this one. Would you agree, or you want to go with the Pirates at home?
No, I would take Michigan State to win this one. I would have probably taken or might have taken Seton Hall with a healthy Miles Powell. But without that, it's just, I mean, you take that guy away from that team, it's a totally different team. And so I think Michigan State wins what could be a competitive basketball game, though. In fact, I expect it to be a competitive basketball game, but Michigan State wins. I am interested to see how Cassius plays, though, because we suspected this was true when we recorded on Sunday. We now know that it's true. The details of the situation, it was a suicide, his younger brother. And, I mean, man, I think it, you know, if you live long enough, unfortunately, in this country, we all have somebody close to us who have taken their own life. I had it happen to me within the past couple of years. And it is, even somebody struggling in the ways that it appears Cassius's brother was struggling, you still, or at least this is my experience, you still don't think it'll happen. You know, you think it won't really go that far. And then the next thing you know, it did go that far. And in this situation, your little brother, somebody you've known your whole life, put himself in front of a train. It's just the saddest, most tragic thing. And I hope you were able to see, if you're listening, Cassius's, I guess it was an Instagram post or Twitter post, really heartfelt, what could best be described as an open letter to his brother. And, you know, he was almost like, I understand. I know how bad you were hurting. I know how tough you were dealing with things. And, you know, next time I see somebody going through that, I'm going to do everything I can to help them. And so that suggests there's some guilt somewhere in there. If you're saying, I'm learning from this and next time I'm going to help the person that I see struggling the way that you're struggling. And I say all that to say this, on Sunday, and everybody mourns differently. I wouldn't pretend to know what's going on inside of Cassius's head, but on Sunday, it's still so fresh that you could just be in shock, you know?
Yeah.
And after a few days, it sets in like that really happened. It's not a dream. And so it'll just be, how will he be on Thursday night mentally? How will he be as a basketball player? How he is as a human is obviously the most important thing, but undeniably that will be a storyline connected to the game and possibly something that determines the outcome on some level.
Yep, there's no doubt about it. Well, we'll see how Cassius and Michigan State responds. Again, that's the big one. We will be back, obviously, for another podcast for you guys on Friday that recaps what we see in Michigan State, Seton Hall. Just a quick note as we wrap up here before GP does the shouts here. I'm putting Syracuse on upset alert against Colgate Wednesday night. Colgate nearly got a win against Clemson. It's its best team ever. And Syracuse is playing its first game since being only held to 34 points. So just keep an eye on Central New York. Let's see if the Raiders can get a steal there. But we'll be back Friday with plenty to talk about and plenty to preview for the weekend.
Shouts to Devin Downey. Shouts to Chester, South Carolina. Shouts to Terry M.F. and Teagle. He is the legend. Shouts to Larnell. Please go subscribe to the Island College Basketball Podcast via Apple Podcasts. It helps us, definitely. That's the main reason I ask you to do it. But the next main reason I ask you to do it is because it ensures you'll get the newest episodes ASAP sent right to your phone. So please go do that. While you're there, rate it favorably. 5 stars, nice comments. And like Norlanda said, we're going to talk to you again on Friday. Preview the weekend. Look back at Michigan State, Seton Hall. Till then, take care.
Paramount Plus and the National Park Foundation present A Mountain of Zen. This Earth Week, you can live stream 7 national parks for 7 days on Paramount Plus. Paramount Plus, official streaming partner of the National Park Foundation.